Campus FM presents a talk in the Works in Progress seminar series entitled A Passion for Birds, Historical, Ecological and Social Aspects of Hunting in Malta and the Mediterranean. The talk is delivered by Dr. Mark Antnefalson.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening to our radio audience. Welcome to the first of the 2007 series of the Work in Progress seminars. We're very lucky to have tonight Dr. Mark Antnefalson, lecturer in the University of Malta. Mark is very well known to us. He is the first student to get a first-class degree in anthropology from the University of Malta. He went on to get a distinction in anthropology at MPhil level from the University of Cambridge, and his PhD from Cambridge, Cosmopolitan Connections, has been published both by Oxford University Press and by Brill. It is a cutting-edge study of global economy and global culture, which pays particular attention to the strange ways in which both capital and men and women and wives and marriages all migrate in an increasingly connected global economy. Dr. Falzon is interested in a wide variety of topics, and he publishes on a wide variety of subjects. But since we're very much immersed in a global economy, I do recommend that you take a look at his book, Cosmopolitan Connections. Well, with those brief remarks, it gives me great pleasure to hand over to Dr. Mark Antnefalson. His paper has the title, A Passion for Birds, Historical, Ecological, and Social Aspects of Hunting in Malta and the Mediterranean.
Thank you, Paul. So I shall be reading. So, A Passion for Birds, Historical, Ecological, and Social Aspects of Hunting in Malta and the Mediterranean. If love, as Prince Fabrizio laments in The Leopard, is flames for a year, ashes for 30, all is not lost for Mediterranean men. At least 10 million of them, by a very conservative estimate, are consumed by a lifelong passion, a folly that appears all but incomprehensible to the casual, outside or inside observer. I refer to the relentless and indiscriminate pursuit of birds, the fact that, as Waldeck puts it, everywhere in the Mediterranean, guns, air rifles, lime sticks, nets and snares are ready to take a bird's life. A particularly telling case is that of Malta, an archipelago state which is home to about 13,000 licensed hunters, a staggering 75 hunters per square kilometer of huntable land. In this paper, I shall take Malta as my point of departure, gradually broadening the scope of my argument into a discussion of historical, ecological and social aspects of bird hunting in the Mediterranean. Before I do so, I wish to declare my stake in the subject, given that this is such an explosive issue. I think I should clarify where I stand. I have been interested in nature ever since I can remember, the date of my first naturalist's notebook entry being 1981. At that time, my main victims were butterflies, many of which sadly found themselves pinned and carefully labeled. Nostalgia. A chance encounter, this is, the t-shirt reads World Cup 1978, so this is, I think, about 1979. A chance encounter at Busquets in 1986, while I was hunting for butterflies, led to my involvement with the Malta Ornithological Society, now BirdLife Malta, which meant partly several years of eager bird watching, partly a zealous militancy against hunting and trapping. I am still today fairly passionate about natural history, but I hold somewhat more balanced views about human-wildlife interactions. The idea that there may be something particular about Mediterranean attitudes towards birds occurred to me while watching Emanuele Crialese's film Respiro, shot on location in Lampedusa in 2002. The film captures very well, albeit indirectly, the obsession of Lampedusan islanders with catching birds. I found myself drawing parallels with Theodosopoulos' descriptions of hunting on the Greek island of Zakynthos, and Lawrence Durrell's of the feathered passions of Cypriot men. I'm referring to bitter lemons of Cyprus. And of course, with my own field experience in Malta, where our journey begins. The taking of wild birds in Malta comes in two main forms. Caccia involves the shooting of migratory birds. either by walking up and flushing them with or without the help of dogs, or by waiting in a hide, a Maltese called a dura. The list of species that are readily shot, legally or not, is very long, but turtle doves, colorful birds, and raptors are among the favorites. Trapping in Siep takes place on specially cleared patches of land called Mansap Maltese, to which migrating songbirds are lured with the help of live decoys and where they can be clep-netted. Most of the birds trapped in Malta are finches that are kept and sometimes carried around in the streets by men as pets and songsters. This is quite popular in the East End of London, by the way. Caged songbirds, and there are all sorts of old Cockney songs about linnets, so it's not just the Malta. In any case, it's beyond the scope of this piece to delve into the history of bird hunting in Malta. I should just note two things. First, rising standards of living in the latter half of the 20th century have meant that Maltese hunters no longer hunt for the pot. Today, birds are shot primarily as trophies, and the typical hunter's home will contain a showcase or two of stuffed birds. Species such as doves, larks, and thrushes are still consumed as delicacies within hunting circles, however, and earlier practices of consuming any type of wild game, especially turtle doves and quail, as a seasonal source of meat are part of living memory. Further, although there is no contemporary trade in game, such as one finds in France, Italy, and Egypt, wild birds were commonly brought to urban markets until the middle decades of the 20th century. The records of the ornithologist Giuseppe Despot, for instance, were based on his daily visits to the wildfowl stores at the Valletta market, where on good days he counted thousands of dead birds of various species, from nightingales to owls. Second, whereas in the past hunting was carried out by landowners, the professional classes and clergy, as well as common folk, with all the often contested and or politicized distinctions of rights and etiquette that implies, shooting and especially trapping today have become largely, not exclusively, but largely subaltern practices. Particularly in the middle class imagination, they figure as an uncouth and anachronistic means of appropriating nature, which modernity should have replaced with bird watching or photography. The lack of elite hunting circles with their I'm not saying that all hunters are non-elite, I'm saying that there is a lack of elite hunting circles with their implications of formal control over land contrasts sharply with other contexts, such as Britain, where, for instance, fox hunting is, or should I say was, given that it has now been outlawed, widely seen as a somewhat decadent and toffish pursuit. Indeed, this was one of the arguments used by Labour members of Parliament, for example, that fox hunting represents an idea of society that is anachronistic and obsolete, kind of an elite, upper-crust society. These are the two main changes. To different extents, Maltese hunters share a passion for birds. They call it namra, which is actually the same word used for courtship. The word is also used to describe a passion for a number of other masculine pursuits, such as pigeon racing and the manufacture of festa fireworks. Namra is the semantic equivalent of the hunting pathos of the Mediterranean island of Zakynthos, the passione of Italian hunters, the jagd fever of German-speaking countries, and the bug that afflicts hunters in the United States. In its purest and most seductive form, namra is believed to be an inherited substance that runs in the blood and passes from father to son, although a number of hunters and trappers are recognized to have become so by contagion, as it were. In the former form, namra is kneaded into the lives of children from a very tender age. Aquilina was a student who did a thesis on hunting, describes an informant whose pride it was to carry his five-month-old daughter around the house, showing her various stuffed birds. At 8 months, she was able to babble pum-pum when asked, "Where is the bird?" With respect to practice, Namra makes one a dilettante, a man who is ready to go to great lengths, such as days baking in the sun waiting for birds, or spending hard-earned cash on decoys, in order to satisfy his passion. The true dilettante has mastered the vast repertoire of technique and lore that is associated with hunting and or trapping. He is also a man who single-mindedly seeks to improve on his knowledge by socializing with other dilettanti, experimenting with new techniques, and watching documentary films on birds. Maltese hunters are oddly ambiguous about their namra. On the one hand, they describe it as an overwhelming passion, an attraction that cannot be suppressed. In this vein, evocative narratives of the early morning light, the landscape, or the companionship of hunting dogs are commonly produced by hunters. On the other, they feel that namra seduces them, literally, into all sorts of hardships and personal sacrifices, often for very little return. The latter feeling has become all the more salient as bird populations have in recent decades declined dramatically. The following is a typical opinion. I tell my son that he should take up any pastime except hunting. Other pastimes provide the occasional boon, but not so hunting. As a hunter, I am constantly frustrated. But there's nothing doing. It's in the blood. During migration, my blood boils to be in the field. Further, Maltese hunting narratives emphasize the idea that namra has the power to alter a man, physically as well as socially. Physically, it is the cause of bodily symptoms, such as loss of appetite and trembling. One hunter told me, I'll say it to Maltese, meta ikun galbu ikolli roda fuqi, favorable weather brings on a nervous tremble. So literally, physically altering the body. Socially, dilettanti cultivate apocryphal, no doubt apocryphal, stories about hunters or trappers who abandon their families, tell ul familia, thus committing the ultimate mortal sin against kinship, in pursuit of birds. In this sense, therefore, namra seeks to come close to the classical definition, dating as far back as Plato and honored by a host of thinkers, including Descartes, of emotion as a feeling that defies rationality and exists outside of society and its most valued tenets. Dilettanti, however, make a distinction between real namra, which is the hallmark of the mature hunter, who is knowledgeable and to some extent discriminating, and the mindlessness, they call it blua, of immature and trigger-happy hunters, often described as boys, tfal. They are keen to point out that their bad reputation derives from the senselessness of a few fools, erbabolo, who have not fully developed their namra into a serious and more acceptable practice. Namra thus functions as a qualitative indicator of masculinity, in that as a man matures, his passion mellows as reason and emotion converge. The real man's namra is more akin to an organized form of human existence, I'm quoting Sartre here, than to an irrational psychological disturbance. The articulation of namra thus brings out very beautifully the oppositions that recent formulations in the anthropology of emotions have suggested. Namra, per se, defies logic and social values, but when tamed by the real hunter, the real man, it translates into rational and social practice. Namra also ebbs and flows with the seasons. Like many other small islands, Malta is poor in resident breeding, that is, birds. Apart from a handful of hardy species like sparrows and warblers, none of which are considered to be particularly interesting to Maltese hunters, the countryside in summer, and to a lesser extent in winter, is relatively devoid of birds. The taking of resident game birds is therefore a notion unknown to the Maltese, and the dilettante must rely on the spring and autumn migrations for his sport. This total dependence on migration and its whims is crucial to our understanding of the anatomy of namra. The power of the emotion owes much to the unpredictability of migration, related as it is to a highly complex set of factors such as wind speed and direction, cloud cover, moon phase, etc. This gives hunting the semblance of a natural pursuit that is only partly within the control of its practitioners. My informants prized this characteristic very highly indeed. One told me, it is the shortage of birds, a chahda, that makes me tick. if I knew that every time I went hunting I would catch something, my namra would disappear. Shortage and anticipation are what make me spend my mornings sitting on a chili stone. During the seasonal migrations, inclement weather, which often but by no means always means larger quantities of grounded birds, brings on namra in its strongest form. On such days, hundreds of men phone their workplaces to report sick, and grooms have been known to turn up late for their weddings. Invariably, Maltese dilettanti lament depleting bird stocks, a trend generally confirmed by ornithological organizations such as BirdLife International. The sharp decrease affects especially some of the most favored quarry species, like turtle doves, for example. And old-time hunters reminisce about the times when scops owls were everywhere, nightjars lined the walls, and doves came in an endless stream. Maltese hunters cultivate a number of theories to explain the decline. The two most favored are that pesticides killed off birds in their European breeding grounds, and that migrating birds have shifted their routes away from Malta. It's not the intention of this talk to try to assess these claims. Very few, if any, hunters will accept that their activities may have something to do with dwindling numbers. Their view is that Malta is too peripheral and isolated, and the volume of migration too small anyway for their delitio to matter. This missing correlation is very telling, because it supports the argument I make below that the notion of sustainable harvesting is largely alien to Maltese hunters. Hunting landscapes. Spatially, hunting in Malta is very particular in that it is not practiced exclusively in segregated spaces. De jure, huntable land is defined as any place that birds may fly over, with the exception of nature reserves, roads, and residential areas. De facto, this generous enough definition tends to broaden somewhat as trappers, and especially shooters, who are mobile and not easily cornered, do not always observe the law. The ubiquity of hunters does not mean, however, that they do not seek to create their specialized spaces. On the contrary, one of the more fascinating aspects of hunting and trapping in Malta concerns the transformation of rural space by dilettanti, and Cherchere Oiseau is the best advice that can be given to those who desire to understand the Maltese countryside. Everywhere, but especially around the coasts, the landscape is systematically transformed into art jebbieda, literally pulling land, that has the potential to pull migrating birds. Trees are planted or uprooted, topsoil added or removed, wild plants encouraged or weeded, depending on the species that one is trying to attract. The process has to be carried out in such a way as to make it as likely as possible for the birds eventually to be shot or trapped. It is also an ongoing project, which is at its best just before every migration season. Then trappers can be seen cleaning, inatfu, that's the word they use, their sites by the controlled burning of weeds and leveling of topsoil. Hunters, for their part, plant and prune trees, and sometimes build little pools of water, known as misit, to attract birds. The ways in which Maltese hunters transform the landscape are distinctly different from the processes described by Richards for grouse moors in Britain. In the latter context, in Britain, gamekeepers transform the land to best keep the game, to propagate and contain the quarry, that is. By contrast, Maltese hunters, dependent as they are on migration, think in terms of attracting birds to their patch. Both systems, of course, share the rationale of eventually bringing birds within shooting range or trapping range. This difference is important because it points towards a type of people-wildlife interaction that may be specific to the Mediterranean. Another point, the importance of which will emerge later on in this paper, is that these transformations into art jebbieda are sometimes combined with agriculture. Farmers, for instance, may plant cereals and other annuals known as zera, Maltese, in ways that also serve to attract, say, migrating quails in March and April. In places where hunting is especially intensive, such as Delimara and, until recently, Tachench and Gozo, land transformations for agriculture and hunting overlap to such an extent that it requires a trained eye to distinguish which is which. The appropriation and transformation of the landscape is also a major bone of contention. There are hardly any off-limits hunting preserved in Malta, hunting preserves in Malta. And despite attempts by hunters and trappers to keep unwanted visitors, such as ramblers and picnic parties, away, the Maltese countryside is increasingly a contested space. In the past, RTO, standing for Reservato, signs were intended to delineate hunting territories, to keep out other hunters, that is, people didn't really go to the countryside at that point. Since the 1980s, however, new understandings and evaluations among the general, well, maybe a bit earlier, actually, among the general population of the countryside as an aesthetic product and the site of leisure have become the source of major tensions with hunters and their projects. This is particularly the case when the space being transformed is a public one, rather than private land owned by or leased to the hunter. In a process similar to the one described by Richards, land transformations bring about contested moral evaluations of the landscape. Environmentalists are fond of pointing out that the eucalyptus trees planted by hunters are non-indigenous species and release toxic substances into the soil, or the trapping sites cleaned so meticulously by their users are a threat to rare and or endemic flora. For their part, dilettanti claim that their activities actually preserve the landscape. In this sense, they see themselves as stewards of the rural landscape, a common self-attribution of hunters in various contexts around the world. Dilettanti and other animals. The contemporary Maltese hunter is ambiguously positioned. Spatially, as well as socially, his namra takes him away from it all. At the same time, it embeds him in a complex set of generally uninvited relations with various actors, notably environmentalists, politicians, and tourists. In Malta, the first environmentalist organizations were set up in the early 1960s. Modeled on their British counterparts, their original main objective was natural history. By the 1980s, however, they had shifted their focus to conservation of nature. I'm referring here to Manuel Castells' typology. They had also enlarged their membership, and due to a self-representation, this is really important, due to a self-representation as European and progressive, built a strong middle-class support base, not least through the use of English as their formal language. In the process, hunters underwent a moral re-evaluation. From harmless sportsmen, they came to be seen as, by everyone of course, but in the general middle-class imagination, they came to be seen as primitive and lawless destroyers of nature, who monopolized the countryside. Today, in spite of their high visibility, hunters and trappers have gone to ground. Their narratives are wholly absent from the public sphere and thrive in an informal world of village tea shops and coded radio messages. Hunters commonly use two-way radios to communicate in encrypted ways, using code names for people, places, and bird species, for obvious reasons. Further, evaluative discourses about hunting often contain a subtext of class notions. However, whilst in many contexts hunters are criticized as an outdated upper crust intent on reproducing distinctions, as I mentioned for the fox hunters in Britain, in Malta, hunters are accused by environmentalists and the middle class in general of embodying an equally anachronistic Mediterranean machismo. Upwardly mobile hunters experience a gradual erosion of the social acceptability of their delitio, to the extent that some give it up altogether. In Malta today, it is broadly not respectable to be a hunter. As one dilettante put it to me, I feel like a criminal when I leave the house carrying a gun, and I tend to do my best to conceal it. This makes it particularly difficult for the hunting lobby to engage with the second type of actor. The first was environmentalists. With the second type of actor, politics. The Federation for Hunting and Conservation, the FKNK, set up in 1973, is intended as a formal structure that represents the interests of Maltese hunters on a national level, and I should say on an international level as well. It is no doubt a significant organization with a membership of thousands, but it has never really managed to garner the grassroots legitimacy one would expect it to enjoy. In the EU parliamentary elections of 2004, a prominent member of the Federation contested but got only a fraction of Hunter's votes and failed to be elected. The reasons were many, one of which being related to my ongoing argument in these seminars that partisan politics in Malta tends increasingly to stifle the development of secular communities and interest groups. But a main one was the failure of Hunters formally to engage with structures. As one Hunter told me, why should we trust him? This is the person who contested. Why should we trust him? He is a businessman, a member of the elite. He can choose to hunt wherever he likes in Europe. How could he ever understand us? Hunters, then, are structurally and formally, I emphasize formally, feeble, which does not mean that they fail to engage with state structures in informal ways or that they lack political and social clout. Their weapons of the weak, and I'm quoting Scott here, the famous idea, notion of weapons of the weak, are the sheer power of numbers and an informal control over space. First, in an endemic political context characterized by a seesaw competition between two major parties, the voting power of several thousand individuals is a very significant pawn indeed, one that Maltese Hunters have consistently played to their advantage, in theory if not in practice. Second, I have already noted that shooters and trappers are ubiquitous in the Maltese countryside and see themselves as being in control of all that it inherits, which includes Neolithic temples, Roman remains, and various other examples of natural and cultural heritage. In 1993, following new legislation restricting spring hunting, an ominous message was painted in the dead of night on the path leading to a UNESCO World Heritage site. It said, "Namra yawintairu." Namra, or we will blow everything up. The threat has never quite materialized, and in truth, hunters have rarely used violence, and then only on an individual basis. But it is certainly something for prospective legislators to contend with. I should probably have said never actually used violence on a collective basis. But the threat is important, of course. The issue of heritage brings us to the relations between dilettanti and the third actor, tourism. In Malta, hunting is very often practiced in places that attract more than their fair share of tourists, typically those seen as being of outstanding natural beauty or rich in archaeological heritage. During the migration periods, shooters and particularly trappers, trapping entails day-long sedentary sessions, become the object of a generally unappreciative tourist gaze. For their part, tourists become voyant visible, viewers that are also seen. This is a notion I take from Merleau-Ponty, of course. Notably in places like Dingley Cliffs, where tourists are encouraged by their guides to take in the view, which includes some of the best and most heavily transformed hunting areas on the islands. Hunting has come to be seen as a hindrance to the development of eco and cultural tourism. The dynamics of this relation are complex and interesting. On most days, the English-speaking press, particularly the Times of Malta, which enjoys the highest circulation figures, carries letters by distraught tourists, usually British or German, writing in to detail some unpleasant encounter in the countryside. Some go so far as to urge a boycott on Malta. Local environmentalists are only too keen to capitalize. Hunters, on the other hand, see it as an unacceptable form of foreign interference. Yet, in the context of a national economy that is heavily dependent on tourist income, and especially within the framework of a policy that is seeking to diversify, at least on paper, by attracting a new type of quality tourist, this argument appears rather flimsy. Interestingly, neither Maltese hunters nor tourism managers have ever sought to market Delizio as an article of cultural heritage, as for instance has happened with the Namra for Festa. Now to what I think is the central idea of the paper. I'm asking the question, can Delizio ever be European? This question, that may seem slightly odd to the outside observer, actually takes us to the heart of much of the contemporary discourse about hunting Malta. First, In a country of ambivalent Europeans, it is not surprising that a practice that seems, or rather has actively been constructed by environmentalists as more Mediterranean than European should be particularly contentious. Second, Malta's accession to the EU in 2004 means that national legislation is now answerable to Brussels, in this case to the Birds Directive of 1979. EU legislation severely restricts the number of species that may be hunted and, more significantly, threatens to outlaw spring hunting, spring shooting, and abolish trapping altogether. As we speak, for example, there is quite an apparently high-level meeting in Brussels discussing specifically this issue. As they see it, for Maltese dilettanti, these last two measures, that is, outlawing spring shooting and abolishing trapping, seem insufferably draconian. As they see it, their whole way of life is being threatened by local politicians held to ransom by distant bureaucrats in tandem with local scheming environmentalists. At the formal level, the Federation for Hunting seeks to counter the assault by pointing out that Malta represents a special case, yet again, in that local hunters are, unlike their northern counterparts, dependent on the migration periods and especially spring. At the informal level, the level of tea shops and radio messages, and dilettanti accuse the EU of self-righteousness and point out that people in Europe may not kill birds but kill babies, a reference to abortion, illegal and widely seen as morally despicable in our self-styled bastion of Catholicism. Besides, they know that law-mongering by Brussels may ultimately not matter much if local politicians turn a blind eye to illegal practices in the untamed Maltese countryside, as they are accused of doing by environmentalists. So Brussels is one thing, but the countryside is quite another. What is really important here is that the standoff between Brussels and Maltese hunters is typical of a broader dynamic. There were substantial protests in Cyprus in 2002, for instance, when the prospect of EU membership brought with it a threat to thousands of trappers. And in northern Italy, hunters make a distinction between European hunting traditions, concocted in recent years from a legacy of Tyrolean tradition, and Mediterranean practice. So, in northern Italy, some hunters are trying to redefine their tradition as northward-looking, Tyrolean, Austrian, rather than Mediterranean, to re-articulate it into something to make it more acceptable. Much of what I have discussed so far, in fact, is typical of political articulations, if not practices, of hunting in other Mediterranean contexts. It would not be an exaggeration to say that one could substitute Zakynthos for Malta in Theodosopoulos' chapter on hunting on that Greek island and not notice a thing. It would appear that with respect to attitudes towards birds, the EU's Mediterranean enlargement has brought with it more diversity than unity. There is, in fact, overwhelming evidence that hunting and trapping in the Mediterranean, and particularly on the European side, are practiced very intensively indeed and lend themselves quite readily to adjectives like indiscriminate and wholesale. The many sources of this observation are unanimous, and I shall limit, so unanimous in the sense that pretty much everyone agrees that in the Mediterranean region hunting is more intensive, much more intensive. The many sources of this observation are unanimous, and I shall limit myself to quoting the most reliable authority, BirdLife International. Hunters kill hundreds of, now not necessarily the numbers, but the most reliable authority in the sense of, hunters kill hundreds of millions of birds as they migrate through the Mediterranean region each year. Of course, hunters would contest this very, very strongly indeed. They, what about these hundreds of millions? We catch maybe two birds on a typical morning. Why is this guy saying hundreds of millions? But this is BirdLife International. Hunters kill hundreds of millions of birds, it adds up, of course, as they migrate through the Mediterranean region each year. Many of these are killed in southern Europe, but a significant proportion are shot or trapped in the countries of North Africa and the Middle East that border the Mediterranean, particularly in Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt. Hunting, which includes shooting trapping using nets, snares, lime sticks, traps and decoys, use of poisons and other methods to catch and kill birds is an important socio-economic activity in this region, particularly in rural areas, involving hundreds of thousands of people and hectares and supporting a variety of groups, including subsistence hunters and trappers, weapon and ammunition manufacturers, bird trap makers, caged bird sellers and restaurant owners. There is much variability in the techniques used to hunt birds around the Mediterranean. Thus, lime sticks, so common in Cyprus, are today virtually unknown in Malta, as are the spring traps used to catch small perching birds in many parts of Italy. The species targeted also vary according to eventual intended use of the quarry. In Malta, for instance, small perching birds, technically known as passerines, are generally left alone, while raptors are considered highly desirable as stuffed trophies. In Cyprus and other places, the opposite is the case, and passerines are very actively exploited as gourmet snacks. These differences granted, the one thing that is broadly common is that the exploitation of birds is particularly intensive around the Mediterranean. Hence the key question of this paper: what to make, as anthropologists, of this Mediterranean passion for birds and its apparent incommensurability with Northern European traditions? On one level, Mediterranean hunting practices could be read as a stage for masculine performances of the southern type, the "I also have a moustache" set of pan-Mediterranean values discussed and problematized recently by Horden and Purcell, amongst others. Theodosopoulos' work on hunting in Zakynthos makes a strong and richly documented case for understandings of this type. There is a saying, and there is a saying in southern Italy and Sicily, that the man who shoots a honey buzzard thus secures 1 year's immunity from being cuckolded by his wife. On a local note, Natalino Fenech's Fatal Flight lays some of the blame for what he calls the Maltese obsession with killing birds at the doorstep of cultural constructions of testosterone. As he puts it, there is something very manly about carrying a gun. The examples are innumerable. There are other aspects of hunting which, when taken in combination, may help us understand intensity of Namra. Hunting, for instance, elicits for the dilettante a number of tactile, visual, olfactory and auditory sensations which conjure up an imagined ideal interaction between man and nature. This is why hunters, when asked what makes them tick, often refer to the smell of morning coffee seasoned with orange blossoms, the beauty of a sunrise, or the sound of cicadas on a hot September afternoon, your actual example. Hunters, particularly and somewhat paradoxically, through their projects of landscape transformation, also experience a sense of continuity, in the sense of reliving a lost imagined past of within carob trees and fields of clover, Silla, just as it does the ridiculously high price tags of paintings by Gianni and others. This nostalgia for a vanishing landscape may explain why, even as the Maltese countryside recedes under a tide of concrete, the number of hunters shows no signs of decline. Actually, they are on the increase. There is also an interesting, if somewhat tentative, argument to be made for the spatial symbolism of migration and its appropriation. Especially on isolated islands like Malta and Lampedusa, the migrant bird becomes a biannual harbinger of connection with the world beyond the horizon. By analogy, some people spend their weekend afternoons at the airport watching planes come and go, and thus ritually overcome, so to speak, their geographical isolation. I'm not just speculating here. 3 years ago, an enterprising student of mine, Nadia Shikluna, carried out research precisely on this. Likewise, the idea of birds appearing out of nowhere fosters a feeling of mobility, a taste of far-off places. Again, I am not just fantasizing. If I may indulge in some introspective ethnography, I know what makes one jump out of bed at 5 a.m. to go bird watching. This is also why vagrant occurrences of birds that stray far from their normal migration routes are so highly prized among hunters and bird watchers alike. These and other aspects of hunting are all, I believe, significant in understanding the seductiveness of Namra. However, none of them works as a way of explaining why bird hunting should be so particularly intensive in the Mediterranean. The value of hunting as masculine performance is well known elsewhere. And anyway, there is nothing particularly macho about sitting in a doura, sipping coffee and watching the sky. The desirability of natural sensations and the attractiveness of reliving a lost past are by no means endemic to any one geographical area. On the contrary, they are staple tropes of hunters' discourses worldwide. And symbols of mobility and location will, in various ways and to different extents, be an essential aspect of culture as long as people live in places, as a Padurai's and Hannard's work shows, for instance. We must therefore resume our search for a different heuristic species. So I haven't explained so far why hunting should be so intensive in the Mediterranean. The classical explanations, in my view at least, don't quite work. My contention is that the answer lies in historical ecological territory. Mediterranean hunting should be understood as the historical product of a very particular type of economic production. The argument is not straightforward and requires one to take up two ideal type dichotomies and then to evaluate their convergence. I shall first look at one aspect of the history of food production. So I'm going to take two different issues, quite separate issues, and then try to bring them together into a synthesis. Food-producing strategies that involve the exploitation of wild fauna and flora are by no means endemic to the Mediterranean. One of the first things I learned about the history of the fens around Cambridge had to do with the tenacity of their inhabitants, the so-called fen tigers. The name, in fact, derives from the disputes that arose in the 17th century, when the Earl of Bedford proceeded to have the fens drained for agricultural purposes, effectively robbing the locals of their traditional dependence on wild fowling, including the legendary punt gunning method, as I have some pictures of it, that still lingers on among a handful of eccentrics. Eel fishing, thus place names like Ely, for example, in East Anglia, and other practices that exploited an ecosystem of marshes and flats and exported its products across the kingdom and beyond. John Thirsk's work on alternative agriculture enables us to locate such examples within a broader historical framework. Thirsk holds that the development of mainstream agriculture, the production of the cereals and meat that constitute the staples of Western peoples, has, in the past several centuries at least, been punctuated by periods in which circumstances changed radically, prompting farmers to seek alternatives. I quote, "The interpretation of our agricultural history stresses a sequence of movements from mainstream farming to alternatives and then back again. Major disjunctures have occurred, obliging farmers to divert their energies from the primary pursuit of grain and meat to investigate other activities. On each occasion, when diversification has been necessary, farmers' ingenuity has been taxed, but it has successfully produced solutions which enable them to survive until the older one returned." Thirsk goes on to present evidence for three such phases of alternative agriculture, as she calls it. The first occurring after the Black Death from 1350 until about 1500, the second between about 1650 and 1750, and the third from 1829 to 1939. She also contends, and I think current developments in Britain support her argument, that a path, a fourth phase, was opened from the 1970s. The details need not detain us here, but we should note two things. First, the notion of alternative agriculture here implies, amongst other practices, an increased exploitation of wild foods, venison, rabbits, wildfowl, and so forth. Second, and perhaps more importantly, alternative agriculture has generally been conceptualized as a response to a crisis which is destined in due course to pass away. Or is it? Thirsk, I should emphasize, is referring to English and Northern European agricultural economies. Things begin to change as we move southward. Horden and Purcell identify a number of factors that historically have led to a marginal type of production in the Mediterranean. This means that whereas in other contexts, shifts from mainstream to alternative types of farming occurred under sporadic and special, and I emphasize this, circumstances, in the Mediterranean, a number of conditions obtained that required people to combine on an everyday and regular basis mainstream farming with other forms of food production. Wild foods, and in particular migratory birds, thus came to represent a regular food source, undertaking an essential strand in the fabric of local communities. One should not make the mistake of over-essentializing this distinction, and I think a healthy way of conceptualizing it is to think in terms of ideal types. In the north, for the non-social scientist, an ideal type is an analytical notion developed by Max Weber, which helps the social scientist to, as he puts it, objectify subjectivity. That is, it creates a certain regularity, a certain pattern that can be evaluated and then compared, and thus avoids the fragmentary nature of social science. This is, in brief, the idea. One should not make the mistake of over-essentializing this distinction, and I think a healthy way of conceptualizing it is to think in terms of ideal types. In the north, an ideal type prevailed that empirically manifested itself in the combination of mainstream with alternative food production strategies on a cyclical and irregular basis. In the Mediterranean, on the other hand, ecological circumstances led to the development of different strategies, which, when extrapolated analytically into a dominant ideal type, gives us a relatively high and regular dependence on wild foods, which explains the historical economic importance of foods such as the beccafichi and ambelopulia, pickled passerines, pickled birds, that is, of Italy and Cyprus, respectively, which were, until fairly recently, exported in their millions around the Mediterranean. No one in Malta today would seriously consider wild birds to be a regular food source, but the techniques of preserving and preparing for consumption all manner of birds, for instance, have only recently begun to slip into folk memory in Malta. Interestingly, this legacy seems to be stronger on the islands. Malta, Zakynthos, Cyprus, Ischia, Majorca, and doubtless many others display a particularly intense exploitation of wild birds, which tends to support, I believe, my correlating hunting intensity with marginality of production, since, as Brodel points out, the historical ecological lot of the average Mediterranean island has been particularly precarious, restricted, and threatened. Would also explain, for example, the differences in numbers of hunters between urban areas and rural areas. With respect to Malta, it is perhaps significant that the very first description of the island, written in 1536, emphasized the aridity and the frugality of the terrain. Divergent notions of people-wildlife interactions. Having outlined the historical importance of hunting as a mainstream Mediterranean food-producing strategy, we must now look at a second, and no doubt related, particularity of human-wildlife interactions in the region. I am interested specifically in the fundamental distinction drawn by the French scholar Bertrand Hell in the course of extensive anthropological work on hunting in Europe. Hell holds that two divergent hunting cultures coexist in contemporary Europe. The first, which spans over a vast geographical area, including all the regions where German dialects are spoken, as well as a number of Central European countries, is based on a notion of hunting as harvesting, in which the hunter is responsible for the management of animal populations. By contrast, in southern European countries and the most of France, hunting is associated with the right, with the notion of a free right of gathering. This notion of a free right of gathering is very evident, for example, in the disputes which occurred in Malta under the knights over hunting land. Natalino Fenech's work, of course, brings this out much more extensively. As I said, I'm not a historian of hunting. Natalino is. By contrast, in southern European countries and in most of France, hunting is associated with the notion of a free right of gathering and the rejection of any idea of reasoned management of the wild fauna. I think Hell is right, with some important qualifications. First, it makes sense, again, to view his distinction as existing between ideal types and to argue that each tends to prevail in its respective geographical stronghold, so not an exclusive argument. This leaves room for all important exceptions, such as the now defunct practice in Malta of encouraging sparrows to multiply in order eventually to produce targets and food. Second, it is reasonable to argue that the notion of hunting as free gathering is particularly prevalent among Mediterranean hunters, dependent as they are on migration, and therefore alien to the reproductive processes of their quarry. Nothing exemplifies better the subtext of free gathering, in fact, than the sudden influx of meat in Exodus 16:13. That evening, quail came and covered the camp, out of nowhere. So there isn't this idea of harvesting, of keeping the game, of helping it propagate. That evening, the quail came and covered the camp, and we gathered it. We can now begin to discern why Mediterranean hunting has become such a contentious, indeed explosive issue. The key notion that Mediterranean hunters find themselves at loggerheads with is precisely that of sustainable harvesting. This notion underwrites the operations of at least three major actors. First, legislation such as the Birds Directive, cooked up in EU kitchens using the ingredient readiest at hand, namely the Northern European conception of hunting as described by Hell. Second, which of course makes the Birds Directive alien to Southern European ideas of hunting as free gathering. Second, environmentalist organizations, the historical dynamics of which dovetail with my argument in the sense that they too are based on a notion of hunting as harvesting. This includes both Northern European NGOs, such as the DBV and Germany, and RSPB, and in Britain, and indigenous Mediterranean organizations, such as LIPU, the Hellenic Ornithological Association, and of course BirdLife Malta. Why? Why does it include both Northern European and the indigenous Mediterranean? The reason is, historically, the discourses of this latter group, that is the Mediterranean group, were nurtured in the soil of colonial or quasi-colonial encounters, or post-colonial encounters, with the North. The model was, and is, conservation, and therefore hunting, as the Northern Europeans do it. The early history of BirdLife Malta is replete with instances of this type. The nature reserve at Adira, for example, was designed along the lines of the RSPB at Minsmere in Suffolk. For many years, young Maltese bird lovers could aspire to the Elizabeth Coxon Award for bird conservation. The list goes on. To all of this, we should add the northbound pilgrimages, now framed within the context of the EU, that Mediterranean environmentalists have, for decades, used to replenish their ideological and, crucially, financial resources. The third actor is somewhat unexpectedly, I think, indigenous formal hunters associations themselves, such as FKNK, who have also taken on board the discourse of sustainable harvesting. In fact, the last K of FKNK stands for Conservazioni, for instance, conservation. This is why these hunters associations often find themselves migrating between crises of ideology in their own countries and crises of representation of practice when indulging in their own northbound pilgrimages to the EU, or FACE, which is the European Hunting Association. It is also why splinter groups are so common, including Malta. There was a splinter group called, easily translated, I suppose, the Aadan Dilettantita Center Ulgabiun, which means association for lovers of the shotgun and the cage. It's not exactly a cage. A gabion is a very large cage that trappers use to put freshly trapped birds in. That's a splinter group. What's the why does it exist? Because FKNK is not managing to sell its sustainable harvesting, at least on paper, idea, because of this historical disjuncture. It is also why splinter groups are so common, representing, as they claim to do, the real concerns of indigenous hunters. So the people of the Dilettantita Center Ugabiu would say, But we are the people who actually represent the real concerns of Maltese hunters. Look at the FKNK. They're all about sustainable harvesting, about game. That's not what we are about, although they would not put it that way, of course. Conclusion. In this paper, I have shifted from a sociological, in the sense of discussing the ways in which hunting in Malta reflects the social order of its age, to a more anthropological perspective to do with people-wildlife interactions. I have argued that with respect to interactions between people and birds, the evidence suggests that there is such a thing as a historical circum-Mediterranean intensive interactional ecological zone. In this light, Maltese hunting, for instance, appears to be less about Mediterranean machismo than about people-wildlife interactions within a very specific set of historical ecological conditions. Of course, the two are not mutually exclusive. But I am arguing that the more important aspect is this idea of historical ecological conditions of marginality, etc., that I've just explained. This should not be taken to imply, my paper should not be taken to imply moral evaluations of hunting based on arguments for or against cultural authenticity and or continuity of tradition. In this paper, in fact, I have shown singular disinterest in evaluations of this type. So I haven't been interested in, is it legitimate not to present hunting as sustainable harvesting? I'm not interested in that. My point has not been to evaluate the legitimacy of the notion of sustainable harvesting, but to trace the ways in which it represents a partial and therefore problematic understanding of people-wildlife interactions, with one or two notable exceptions. Social anthropology has never seriously engaged with Mediterranean hunting-gathering practices. It is our task to redress the balance, and in so doing, to de-exoticize the hirsute men and their burning passions.
I'm sure you have questions you want to raise. I just want to very, very briefly refer to three points or areas of his talk. The first, of course, is that, as some people here know, he was taking his stand very firmly in the analysis of Horden and Purcell's book, The Corrupting Sea. And in that book, Horden and Purcell, many students here are familiar with, argued very strongly that we must not continue to use Northern European concepts of economic development, such as mass production or individual specialization, in understanding the Mediterranean. Mediterranean ecology means we have to develop economic concepts which are specific to the whole Mediterranean region. And, well, there's, I think, secondly, that he's tried to extend this idea of Horden and Purcell to the current conflict between hunters and ecologists. And he's tried to say that, to suggest, if I understand you correctly, that notions of conservation in Malta are too dependent on Northern European ideas of conservation. And I think that's quite provocative. And just a third point, which among the many he made, which I'd like to refer to, and this is his argument, if I understand you correctly, that hunters are structurally feeble. They're not really all that threatening. They have a certain electoral strength, but he seems to be, again, following Dimitrios Theodosopoulos' study of the island of Zakynthos in Greece, in which Theodosopoulos said that the hunters in that island lost, in simple language, the battle for words. They lost the political battle for words. Or in technical academic jargon, they lost the discourse. They lost control of the discourse. Hunting discourse is very subaltern or subordinate to the discourses of all the major parties and the middle class. So those were three points which interested me, which I thought are really rather provocative and go against the popular grain of thinking. But I'd be very interested to see what the audience has to say and what questions they have to ask Mark.
I have to thank Mark for a very interesting talk, and which has actually given me a fresh insight on hunting, at least in Malta. I have sort of come to realize that perhaps there are elements of gambling in hunting as this practice in Malta, because you quoted a hunter who said that the uncertainty of not knowing whether birds will even fly over his hide is part of the fascination of hunting. So it is actually a mixture of skill, because the hunter must have some skill to shoot him, and luck, which would explain why, for example, target shooting is not a satisfactory alternative, because that is almost totally skill without any luck. I'm not convinced that hunting is really a residue of a rural economy, because usually food production is not something which elicits passion, comparable to hunting. You know, it's a utilitarian activity, and if wildlife is a food supply, if when there are other sources, easier and more reliable sources of food, usually, you know, people, farmers, for example, readily change over, so they are not so passionate, obsessive almost, and that is why almost also I think about this, the elements of gambling, because we know that gambling is also a widespread obsession, which is not very well known. I think, I don't know if there are any statistics, but gambling is a problem socially as well. In Malta, I don't, probably in the other Mediterranean countries as well. So, and it is, if it is an obsession, it is very difficult to get the people who are suffering from that obsession to describe themselves. Because, you know, it's difficult for somebody even to admit that they have an obsession. Or as we say, in Maltese we call it vice, but really it's not.
I think that's
that is a moral
judgment. Yeah, of course, hunters would not see themselves having an obsession. First of all, I would point out that, but obsession, not in the derogatory sense of the word, there's a vice. Yeah, but in a reasoned way. In fact, they do point out the difference between the boloch, who are obsessed in a completely indiscriminate way, but this is a theoretical distinction, of course. And the real hunters, who also are discriminating to some extent, etc. So they are expected to be somewhat controlled in their behavior. I mean, dealing with gambling, I suppose, is interesting. But I think what it does, this idea of luck and unpredictability, is that it makes hunting seem more natural as well, because the hunter is not in control over the quarry. So the hunter comes face to face with nature, culture versus nature. Culture, which is about control, etc., versus nature, which is out of the hunter's control. So I think that adds to it. I want to say something about the obsession, but I forgot it, actually.
Well, if I may, Mark, I think we're taking a bit this argument at face value, without this thing of hunting and not expecting and not knowing what you're going to hunt. And I said this because a larger number of hunters are going every year now hunting abroad. So they go to Egypt, where hunting is guaranteed, where large bags are guaranteed. They go to the UK to shoot with pigeons in larger numbers. So this argument of going to hunt and not knowing what you're going to shoot is a bit, I think it's a bit,
it's a bit shallow. I think we should not overemphasize it. Definitely not. The same would apply for bird watches, for example. Bird watches go abroad. But at the same time, I think probably bird watches would agree with this. They do find themselves coming back to Malta and sort of wishing for occasional hoopoe to fly past or something like that, in spite of the fact that they see a million hoopoes in Egypt or whatever. And they do find themselves longing for the Maltese experience, where a hoopoe is not rare, but it's not a very frequent happening. So I agree with you completely, Natalino, that's, in fact, hunters are more pleased on good days when there are more birds, when there are less birds. But I think what they are saying is not actually shortage, although chahda does translate into shortage. It's more the unpredictability of it that they are emphasizing. Then again, I would have to agree with you that, for example, if you go to Scotland or wherever, it's not unpredictable. I don't find that many Maltese, correct me, more than me on this, but I don't find many Maltese tend to go to, for example, pheasant shoots. I think it's more...
Class.
I think it's more wild game that they tend to go for, etc. So there is still that element of unpredictability. Hunter I was talking to the other day actually said that he's just been shooting in England, I think. And he shot hundreds of birds. And he said, after 4 days, I found myself wishing... I was in Malta, longing for an occasional turtle dove to fly past. So it's very much an ambiguous. I think you are perfectly right, but I also think I am right. I think it's an ambiguous case. I think you do well to point out that one shouldn't simplify it. Definitely, I agree with you there. But I don't think one can rule out the argument of shortage, of chahda, of unpredictability, of the idea that we are here, birds are not that common, and there is also a competition between hunters, as of course.
And if I made a second comment about your last slide where you were showing the hunting season to show the fluctuations, I think that that what has happened was that historically birds were hunted or trapped mainly for food. And basically, there was an all-year-round thing going on. So in sparrows, trappers were trapping sparrows because they would make them into sparrow pies.
Because they were
and hunters were shooting sparrows as they were coming into roost. So, I mean, after the turtle dove shooting season, they were shooting swifts, and then they were shooting sparrows. And then August comes, and the occasional turtle doves come again. So there was a whole cycle of shooting all year round. But mainly it was shooting for the pot, because even swifts and sparrows were eaten at the time. Mm-hmm. So basically, had an all year round shooting and trapping cycle, which now has changed.
Which would tend to support my argument that wild foods were an essential part
of
the
diet. Yes, definitely.
Because if you need to shoot sparrows in summer, then surely you can't do without them, as it were.
One thing is for sure that, I mean, hunting provided a pastime when few other pastimes were available, because I think we have to put things in a social context. I mean, we look at stuffed birds today as something despicable. We don't like to see stuffed birds. But in the 50s and 60s and 70s, there were Intaglira shops where you could go and buy a cheap jar to put on your TV set, while the guy next door could provide you with a golden oriole, which could stay on the television set, and it's nice and colorful there. So there were cultural connotations all along. Where I tend to disagree a bit with you is about this Mediterranean thing, because if you have to, there's a good book, Southern Hunting in Black and White, which describes quail shooting in, I think, in California or somewhere in America. And I think there are quite a lot of parallels between Maltese hunters and American hunters. And if you see even the lobbying of the hunters' associations, it's very similar to the National Rifle Association kind of lobbying, where they're pressuring politicians to do what they want them to do.
Right.
And if I may just...
This is common even in Northern Europe. I mean, fox hunting debate in Britain.
Yes. But the cultural attitudes of hunters hunting in groups and meeting in bars, I find more in common with the American hunters, the quail hunters, than with anywhere else.
Are there Maltese in California?
Probably.
Should support my.
One thing that you're thinking about the political notion of hunters, the lack of political clout, more significant than the European elections, I find the local council elections. And a couple of years ago, you might remember when the hunters fielded the candidate at Rabat. I don't know what it was, 6 years ago or whenever. And Rabat, there are about 1,000 hunting licenses, and this guy got less than 200 votes. So it's more than just bipartisan. I think there's a lack of faith in hunting on the political arena, even on the local level.
On a formal level.
So
it's obviously a hugely extensive topic, and what I did today was just sum up a few aspects of it. I think your point on quail hunting in California, etc., that of course deserves further thought. But the rest, I think, I probably agree with you, but thank you.
One thing else about tourism, if I may add, is that, because you mentioned the letters in the papers today, you'd find letters in the press before the NGOs came into being.
Yeah.
So in 1954, for example, there are letters in the Times.
Oh, yeah.
And letters after two pelicans were shot in 1958.
Sure.
Or whatever. That's before the NGOs came into being.
Yes.
So this, the foreigners shunning these local barbaric practices, which at home had already stopped.
Mm-hmm. But of course, then the local NGOs fed into this.
Yes,
of course,
definitely.
You're right. But I think from the very origins, local NGOs, environmentalist NGOs, directly fed into this discourse, partly by using English as well, Times, etc. So created that respectable middle class image for themselves. And I think hunters realized what was happening a bit too late, actually. That's my opinion here, not as an anthropologist.
You have just listened to a talk in the Works in Progress seminar series entitled A Passion for Birds, Historical, Ecological and Social Aspects of Hunting in Malta and the Mediterranean. The talk was delivered by Dr. Mark Antnefaltson.